more interaction terms and the potential that we hadn't thought of. Some kind of interesting initial conditions, interactions, you know, depends on the shape of this thing, depends on where it's frozen in, outside the horizon, inside the horizon. So there's some sense of which this is an interaction with gravity. Or it could be an interaction with other fields. So that's been one of the primary ways that we've seen can generate non-Gaussianity of the local type, which is, you know, to some extent what we might be seeing. So essentially, once we talk about non-Gaussianity, we're talking about interactions. And that brings us to a whole new world of what does consistency of how we calculate observables mean. So you might think, you might or you might not think, based on various reasons, that we can describe inflation as some sort of effective field theory. So whether you think that's that really makes sense in a complete way, or whether you just say that when we do things like calculate perturbations, we're in some sense assuming that we can use a low energy effective picture, which we are. What that means is that even if we're just doing something like calculating a two-point function in non-Gaussianity and ignoring sort of global issues of the consistency of inflation, we need to make sure that at least that part of the calculation is consistent. So no surprise, right? No big deal. But what's interesting is that although this is sort of, you know, trivial, I guess, in slow roll, once you start adding interactions that can generate large non-Gaussianity, it becomes a little more interesting. So an interesting test case is the case of small sound speed models. These are single field models with just sort of one new parameter that can generate observably large non-Gaussianity. And I think this is a useful sort of phenomenological or toy test case because it is simple and it does have sort of an interesting basis in a string theory construction. So again, whether that string theory construction genuinely works and gives you a model of inflation that satisfies all observables, it does give us a background where we understand the sound speed and the changing sound speed related to some, you know, sort of underlying physics, and we can use that underlying physics to help us once we get stuck at points of the sort of phenomenological level. So, and of course, last but not least, this is sort of an observable probe of interesting physics, so it's not totally, you know, speculative to be considering this.
Okay,
so sort of in the spirit of Rachel's talk yesterday, I want to distinguish between a few types of questions or a few different perspectives to use to approach this problem. And basically, the first point is just what we all know, is that we're interested in observables that can distinguish in a, you know, an interesting way between models. And as we've heard, if, you know, the observation that or the hint or whatever you want to call it stands up, we already know that smooth single field slow roll can't give us that. So this is obviously a very interesting observable. So we can measure it, we can ask what its value is, and then we can say, well, is that what we expected at all? You know, especially, as I'm sure you know, in the case of the tensor scalar ratio, it's very interesting to try and say, if we see a large value, does that mean we don't know what we're talking about in terms of this theory? And to a certain extent, you can do that with non-Gaussianity too. And then, so you can take a completely observational approach, sort of a phenomenological approach, but then you can also ask, we have specific constructions that we think come from physics that sort of holds together at a deeper level. What guidance can we get from those to go back upwards? So again, the sound speed is exactly a case that you can treat at any of these levels. So that's why I think it's useful, and whichever level you prefer, you can stick with and think about it in that way. Okay, so my plan is just to, first of all, remind you what this simple sound speed model looks like from sort of a phenomenological point of view, and why it already has some interesting features that have sort of pointed us in the direction of asking, you know, what are the observable, the measurable sizes of observable quantities. So I'll just remind you of a few interesting features already, and then get to the main part of the talk, which is to discuss consistency. And this is a really, I mean, it's a really sort of simple approach. It's the simplest thing you can do to ask if your calculation makes sense. The interesting thing is just that you get out an answer that actually limits you, which you don't in the slow roll case. So if you're doing something like, you know, reconstruction of models or something like that, it's good to be aware that that's something you need to consider and impose on your reconstruction. And then I'll show you just briefly, if I take this phenomenological limit that's easy to derive and apply it to say the DBI model and then the observational constraint, what happens? Okay, so phenomenology. So I don't think this has actually appeared yet on any slide, which is amazing because this is a very general setup for these models. Basically, started by Mukhanov and collaborators, the idea that you can sort of generalize, get away from the slow roll regime by generalizing a little bit and writing an action that's a function of the inflaton phi and a combination of first derivatives here. So basically, if you like, for the background, this x is just phi dot squared. So you're writing a term that has the usual kinetic term and, you know, some powers of that or whatever. And what's nice about that model is that it just has this one new parameter, this sound speed. You can see that if you have canonical kinetic term, that disappears or goes on the hockey stick. And sound speed goes to 1. And if you have something more interesting, this term appears, and in most reasonable constructions, drives CS less than 1. So that's a simple parameter. And then you can ask how that parameter changes with scale. So as Mari actually showed yesterday, this model is a lot like slow roll in the sense that you still have your nice parameters epsilon and eta, where again, epsilon just gives you the condition for accelerated expansion. And you have a new parameter that tells you how the sound speed is changing. So this is the quantity that we were hoping to constrain along with the magnitude of non-Gaussianity. And you can use it, you can either use it as coming directly from the sound speed model or sort of a proxy for whatever kind of physics you might be thinking is scaling the non-Gaussianity. And this also needs to be, you know, sort of a less than 1 number in order for our usual solution to the mode equation to go through. So sort of the standard solution you expect to continue. And the way this parameter is written is really nice because it tells you that how CS depends on scale is simply, you know, k over k naught to the k. Okay, and you also saw, but let me just review real quick what happens to the observables. So the factor CS and the parameter kappa show up in some of the things that we want to measure. So basically, you have even more freedom with getting your 1 number, your 0.97 or whatever, because now you have a new parameter. You can balance all those things off each other. The really interesting thing is the sound speed changes where scalar modes exit, but not tensor modes. So you get this interesting factor of CS in the tensor scalar ratio. And then finally, as we've seen, for non-Gaussianity, which is of the equilateral type, if you sort of write the effective FNL parameter from the equilateral limit of those triangles, you see that it goes like 1 over CS squared. So there's some model-dependent prefactor there, but that's the essential behavior. So this point and this point so far drive some interesting possibilities for physics. So that's sort of the CS and its running is really the heart of what we want to think about here. So just to keep in the back of our mind an example, and I want to keep this example because it's easy to visualize and because it has particularly simple solutions for how this CS parameter enters, is this example of DBI inflation. So I know you all have heard probably endless talks about this, but basic idea is the inflaton is just some position of some brain in this warped background. So we believe that, or you know, we imagine that we can construct this background space and this warped geometry in some consistent way where we know the scale that we've used to set all of this background physics. So what that does is really interesting in the action for the brain, because before we even talk about fluctuations, the action for the D3 brain is interesting because it has this square root. So I haven't written the action, I've written this parameter gamma, but you've probably all seen the action that just has this square root term in the top. So it's canonical kinetic plus a bunch of stuff. What's interesting is we think that somehow we know how to sum up all of those higher derivative terms into this square root. So it's already interesting because we can get a very large value of non-Gaussianity because we think we know how to do that. So interesting in and of itself, but also interesting because this function that controls the speed limit is a function of the brain position, which means a function of scale during inflation. So this is something that's, again, you know, given to you, you can sort of solve the background supergravity solutions to figure out what this is and how it might differ from this answer. But you think you understand that, and you understand the scale of the background, this capital R4 that enters there. So interesting. And you know, visually what happens is you can picture this as sort of this cone geometry, and it doesn't really, you know, go all the way to a singular point, but it smooths off at some point, and that's going to actually be interesting for what we get to at the end. The other great thing about this model is because you know this form for how you sum up derivatives, you actually can compute all these derivatives, p, comma, x, remember x was that phi dot squared thing, really easily. And the relationship to the sound speed is relatively simple. So in particular, the first one is just 1 over the sound speed. So a lot of things simplify compared to these to very more generic models where you might write down a generic action for that, you know, a general p of x. So it's a little simple. Okay, so let me just remind you of 2 reasons why this is already sort of an interesting modification of a typical slow roll picture. And here's the first one you've probably seen. Simplest idea is, again, this is one of those things you can argue about if you think this is fundamental or how fundamental it is, but it seems like, at least in string theory, we have some difficulty in getting fields that run over a super Planckian field range, especially for these brain positions. So if you look at the usual chaotic inflation model with m squared phi squared potential, and you look at the condition such that you have inflation, you find that you need your field to be at some, you know, super Planckian values. Okay, well, that's hard to find. The great thing about the sound speed, and here I've just generalized to something that can, you know, be any, I've used the usual relationship between, you know, m Planck squared h squared is v, so I have a potential energy dominated system, but I've had a general power law here. The point is that for the same condition of accelerated expansion, the CS pushes this number down, And you can actually have sub-Plankian field ranges and get inflation. So this is how essentially DBI inflation manages to semi-work, even though it has a limited field range. So that's already an interesting improvement. And the other thing that it does for you is just modify your expectation of the tensor scalar ratio. So I'm treating, this is the old life bound number of e-folds, so defined this way. And you can relate that in a simple way by sort of plugging in the potential and, you know, plugging in your tensor scalar ratio there to find a relationship between the distance the field travels, number of e-folds, and the observed tensor scalar ratio. So the point usually is made that if you have r that's constant, this thing less than one, often much less than one, you don't get a very large value over here. Okay, that's true, that's great. An interesting thing about the sound speed is, and again, whether you think you can actually construct these values in some way is another question from a model, but basically, if you allow the sound speed to run, you can have r that's large at CMB scales and rapidly drops off. So if you allow r to change quickly, you need to do an integral instead of just turn your del phi del ne into a, you know, a field range. And if you do the integral for some, you know, optimistic but reasonable parameter values, you can get something that's observably large. So that's, those are the two reasons that the sound speed is already interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. No, sorry, this is very naive, but it's very confusing. I thought you argued convincingly that r could never be 0.1.
So this is a pretty extreme case, because what I've done is I've set this equal to 1. So that's sort of at the borderline of what's acceptable, the field range. And for DBI to work, it actually, you know, if you put in observational constraints, this needs to be greater than like a third. So it needs to be very, very close to Plankian, which probably is semi-legitimate, right? You still need to worry about corrections there. So it's very semi-legitimate. And I've also taken the running to be as large as possible. So this is a slow roll parameter. I've taken it to be very large, just on that interval. So this is an extremely optimistic case, but I think it's legitimate, semi-legitimate, purely from the point of view of plugging in parameters and asking, could I control this? Maybe.
So there's a 10 to the 14 somewhere that Daniel mentioned.
No, so what happens with DBI, yeah, I'm sure, what I can say is that what happens is that if you look at a construction of brain inflation with a D3 brain, and you actually know how the volume of the throat in the most optimistic case is related to how you set the 40 like that, you end up with a 1 over a very, very large number, and that number is very large, you know, for reasons of any other data. So you do end up with something that's extremely, extremely out of the question. So this is not from any construction. This is just saying, from a logical point of view, could I possibly imagine that maybe I can control this and get larger?
But is there any construction that could give you that?
No. I mean, there's no construction that's totally controlled.
Existing construction, but it cannot be very fast. Sarah just saying, keep more general. You have a specific for GKP compression. Keep it general as a DBI inflation. It's a field theory model. You don't have to. Maybe it can be realized in some other setup.
You have a comment? You have a comment?
No, I agree. So what I was talking about is specific, an explicit construction, and when you fix these microscopic parameters, what they have to be in order to satisfy other observables. So this 10 to the 14, for example, comes when you want to satisfy that there are normalization.
Within a certain.
Sure, but if you treat this action morphologically and allow these parameters to be not directly connected to some microscopic.
Yeah. So I think also Rachel mentioned there are a couple of ways that you might try to relax that, but none of those ways are totally under control. And you know, whether that not under control manifests itself as that changes your inflationary observables, or whether it's just something about the background geometry, or, you know, I don't know how well you can control that, even in Jingong's IR case, where you try to do a calculation, you know, it's something where you really have in conflict with the warp string scale, but you still imagine that you can calculate the spectral index somehow. So all of these models, you might imagine you could still control them in some way, but it's not great.
But so even still, even if I take the purely phenomenological point of view, I think maybe Nayesh asked this yesterday, but I would think that these large values of kappas are very unnatural, because to get NS minus 1 to be 0.97, you have to complete epsilon and eta to be one of them to be 0.2 or 0.3.
So
you still want to have 60 folds.
That's right. So basically what happens in sort of this, I mean, so none of the constructions that we've written do exactly this, but I can tell you what might happen, which is based on the sort of intermediate regime of brain inflation, where you start with something that looks like slow roll. And so basically NS minus 1 is just dominated by, say, epsilon and your potential. So it can be close to 0.96, and r can be relatively large. As you go down into this case that looks more like DBI, and you're dominated by this behavior of warp factor, what happens is eta goes to 0, and kappa exactly cancels the two epsilon terms. So ns goes exactly to 1. And that corresponds to r getting very small. And you can still get enough equals because you're in this relativistic regime, you know, up to issues of how well you can control your back reaction. So you could imagine that there's some regime that's sort of a transition between the two regions that we can calculate very easily and match these parameters, you know, and somehow that goes smoothly. So I think it's not impossible because you have enough parameters.
I'd say even when kappa is minus 0.3, you can have a transient solution.
I think Brett's paper has shown that.
Isn't it transient? No.
No, I mean the exact solution for ABS region, right, is kappa equal minus 2 epsilon. And then in that region, of when it's exactly ABS, you can easily calculate it and should be able to track your solution. I mean, you know, obviously this is, you need to do some work to make sure this actually makes sense, but it's not, you know, it's not obviously wrong.
Sorry, I think I misunderstood.
Okay.
So do you claim that you have a model for which, let's just say, some inflationary solution for which you can get kappa to be this over some significant range?
So I think what I'm claiming is that if I do something like what Bologna and Daniel did, I try to construct, and I think their case actually doesn't get very close to the ABS solution, so I think they don't see this. Mm-hmm. But I think if you did something, and that's the reason is it's hard to expand around the ABS solution and for term, you know, to get a family of solutions around it. But I think if you could do that and do an analysis kind of with a level that they did, you should be able to pick this. And that would be interesting to actually check that. But I think it should be possible. And I guess the question of whether you need to go super, I know super Planckian or whatever to sort of hit the attractive solution at the right point and all that, you know, I don't know. But.
I think the related point is that for DBR, ns minus 1 is about the epsilon squared, is that right? Or no, there's a kappa in it.
There's a kappa, but if you assume you start in the school roll regime, so you have, you see, kappa is essentially 0.
Okay. Ah, oh, so then, but then, okay.
So I did want to point this out because I think sometimes this the case for this gets slightly misstated or overstated. And, you know, we should distinguish between what we can construct with a model, which, you know, really is very far-fetched model in a way, and what just looks reasonable on this level. So I think to do these kind of general phenomenological constructions imposing the most general experience we have would still be important.
Okay, so now let me get on to that point, which is consistency. So even given what I just wrote down, you know, we can still go a little bit further, and once we start calculating things like non-Gaussianity, I'm going to run out of time, we can do a couple of other consistency checks. So let me talk about that. So the next few slides are things presented here. And I guess I want to stress that I don't think any of this is surprising. None of this is, you know, some new calculational technique that you're going to be shocked by. It's just applying sort of this, you know, the simplest thing you can think of doing and seeing what the answer is for these small sound speed models. So when we calculate usually the power spectrum and then go on to calculate something like non-Gaussianity, which typically we take to be the three-point function, even though, of course, it means many, many things other than that, we're usually assuming two things, such that this is reasonable. The first is that the energy of the fluctuations of the inflaton are small compared to the background. So usually we say we have some potential energy, and that's dominating our background solution to get inflation. If the energy in fluctuations is large, those fluctuations can be kinetic energy, gradient energy, generally things with the wrong equation of state, right? So besides the fact that if your energy in fluctuations is large, you need to go back and recalculate your background, they can also, in a sense, you can imagine them as driving you out of inflation because they have large gradients or something. So that's the first condition. The second condition, I would say, is that whenever we do the calculation of the two-point function, we're, you know, looking at the term that's quadratic in fluctuations, writing down the mode equation, something like the, you know, the Mukhanov equation, and saying that's our answer for the power spectrum. So that's great, and in slow roll, that's really no problem, as I'll remind you. But as soon as we start being interested in observably large non-Gaussianity, we have to check that those interactions don't come back and correct the two-point function in a significant way. So I'm going to call that the sort of interaction picture condition related to the sort of technical way that you can, you know, do these expansions a la Malvasena or Weinberg and the consistency of that. So those are my two conditions. You can probably think of more. And before I launch into this, I just want to say, keep in mind that I'm not claiming much about what this means. You know, violation of these bounds, this arrow doesn't go either way, corresponding to inflation ends or not. You can certainly imagine that your background solution driving you to epsilon greater than 1, and inflation ends without ever violating this stuff. Or you can imagine that somehow I violate one of the bounds that I'm going to show you, but it's possible to rearrange the information or make a better, more global description such that you can actually continue on with your inflationary calculation. And one of the things about this that also makes it great to keep this background picture in mind is you can imagine trying to ask which of those possibilities actually happens once you hit this bound. So that's another reason that I want to imagine the DBI. So let me just remind you a little bit. Some of these equations appeared before, so probably you're familiar with them. About the sort of setup I'm going to work in. Basically, the ADM formalism and some gauge choice, which is going to be moving at the moment. So you can write the metric like this, these lapse functions that we saw yesterday in David Series talk. And I'm going to take delta phi to be 0 and hij to be this. So my one remaining scalar degree of freedom is this zeta here, the curvature essentially, which is constant outside the horizon in the absence of isocurvature. So it's a good variable to work with. And the great thing about this ADM formalism, et cetera, is that then you can just solve for the first order solution for these n functions, and you get the action out to cubic order in the fluctuations exactly. So for not very much work, we get an action that we can write schematically as this, where we have S0, which is sort of the background piece. Essentially, that's the classical, dominated by this classical potential part. S1 vanishes when things satisfy equations of motion. S2 is quadratic in fluctuations. That's typically what we use to calculate the two-point function. Then there's a bunch more stuff, but at least for free out of this, we get S3, which is cubic in fluctuations. So at a minimum, we get that. You can refer to these excellent papers. And so what do we typically do? Typically, we say, OK, let's quantize the fluctuations. Let's use that quadratic piece to write down a mode equation. I've included the CS squared here. Solve that, and you know, you get something that oscillates, and then at horizon crossing has an amplitude that goes something like this. And here the CS appears also. Okay, so what am I going to do? What do you do with that? Typically, you define the power spectrum, and I just go through this so that we can take a physical observed number at some point and plug it into these calculations. The two-point function, you can define the power spectrum and the dimensionless power spectrum, and I'm just going to put some magnitude here, some normalization, and the usual running. And you can check that if you change gauges back to the spatially flat gauge where you're fluctuating thing, your degree of freedom is really that inflaton field, you can use the usual first order gauge transformation here and check that in the limit where you have the sort of canonical case where CS and P comma X are 1, that you recover delta phi is H over 2 pi. And then in a more general case, you're going to have these two terms present. For DBI, like I said, it's nice and simple because these two terms exactly cancel to 1. So simple case. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, in some sense, maybe a little approximate, but I think it's the first thing you would do, and sort of semi-justified by, again, by David Series talk about how we should take, what region we should take as the quantum field theory region, and what region we should take. So a different approach, most practically. And I'm going to write the two conditions, the gradient energy and the interaction picture condition, just as S2 over S0 less than 1, and S3 over S2 less than 1, just meaning that where these things, when I give a magnitude for these things, I'm evaluating them essentially with this horizon crossing value, which is what we do for observation. So seems reasonable. And with the additional caveat that this condition, really, this interaction condition is a loop calculation, right? I'm really calculating in the loop the effect of the 3-point on this 2-point. I'm not going to do that calculation, right? So it's been done in some cases. Weinberg has an example for multiple field cases. And essentially, up to a log term, this is the answer that you get out. That's the condition. So for some operators, some very crazy things you can imagine putting in your action that may or may not be true, the relevance of that loop, et cetera. But that's how I'm going to treat it. Yeah. What's that?
Why isn't S sponsor? Because I think I'm trying to loop through the
box. Sure, this is not the only correction. And to be honest, there are a whole bunch of conditions like this, right? This is the one that I get for free without doing any more work in the last functions. And it's sort of the first correction that's going to come in. Right, and it's the one directly related to the non-guess A as we usually calculate it. So. So a little bit of a caveat here, but I think.
That first one is not very clear to me. So S naught, what is S naught?
So basically, that's dominated by the potential energy, right? V of phi. So that's the usual solution. Right?
Okay, so you're basically in the back reaction at this point.
Yeah, so S2, I mean, you can maybe a better thing to do is to take delta T mu nu, but essentially, you get basically the same thing because S2 is the gradient energy.
Can I ask a really hanging question? So now, can I understand your story about kappa and R in this language? I appreciate the speed of sound appears in this. Maybe it's a trivial one, but so naively you would have said, so in these models you want small speed of sound to alleviate the Eta problem.
Right.
And small speed of sound to keep this to be Eta minus 5, you'll need a smaller Hubble in general.
Exactly.
Which will suppress.
Exactly.
So your story is that CS is order 1 for CMB scale, so you can have large, but then you allow for, okay, just want to make sure.
Yep, that's probably the right.
But then you allow large running, so you can have something fun. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let me just remind you, in slow world, these conditions are kind of trivial. Basically, if you look at the gradient energy condition, it ends up just telling you that h over m Planck needs to be less than 1. Okay, that's sort of something we assume from the outset. So that's totally a reasonable condition and nothing you need to worry about, probably, unless you're Andre Leydig, maybe. But and then the interaction bound, interestingly, also gives you essentially nothing for the condition that you're in an inflating solution where epsilon is less than 1, because you just get h over m Planck less than 1 over epsilon. So that's less constraining, in fact. And part of the reason that you can actually get eternal inflation in the sort of perturbative regime is exactly this extra factor of epsilon. And you can see that sort of the usual argument given for these extra factors of epsilon is that when you go to the de Sitter limit, all of your fluctuations at this order, if you had any, would just become pure gauge mode. So those things all need to go to zero. So that's how people usually justify this epsilon, and then that's what you get. So not much interesting in slow world. Essentially, that's how, in fact, how people first estimated, if you look at original papers, estimate FNL, right? So that's okay,
so let me exactly remind you of this point, that in the local model, we already use this intuition all the time, right? Typically, we say, well, let's write zeta as some Gaussian piece and some nonlinear piece. And when we say we want this to be mildly non-Gaussian, basically, all that we mean is, in fact, that this correction is small. So if we write the two-point function, we get back the answer we expect. So in numbers, all that means is that FNL squared sigma to the fourth, if you like, less than sigma squared, FNL sigma less than 1, FNL less than this number that's set by what we observe. So this is essentially the same thing that's going to come out for a more general model, and I just want to show you that's what you should expect. Okay, so with sound speed, we can do all this again, and not much changes. Basically, what's happened is that the scalar fluctuations have a sound horizon now, so you can imagine taking your large Hubble volume and drawing lots of little sound horizons inside of it. So it's going to change the expression for the gradient energy. And if you write S2 again, it's a really simple modification to include the sound speed. You can do the same condition that we had before, and this is the answer. So essentially exactly Justin's point, first of all, it recovers the usual intuition when CS goes to 1. And then you have the point that as sound speed is small, the overall energy needs to go down so that this is consistent. So H needs to get smaller as CS gets smaller. Otherwise, you can get too much energy in your fluctuations. You can get large gradients, probably taking you out of the inflationary regime. The interaction condition is a little bit more. You can write the S3, and this is certainly not the whole thing, but it's sort of the terms that are probably most important. You can see that when CS squared equals 1, so the canonical case, and kappa equals 0, we recover that just epsilon scaling that was relevant before. But the interesting thing, first of all, this equation shows you sort of how to quantify whether you're in the slow world regime or the small sound speed regime, because you can just compare how far CS is from 1 compared to epsilon. If CS is quite far from 1, then this 1 is the dominant term here, and you get a condition that looks like this. Okay. So the nice thing about this is you can rearrange it exactly as you probably expect in terms of the power spectrum P zeta. So your condition now looks something like this quantity, which after all was just our P zeta, is less than CS to the 4. So with keeping in mind that in general FNL goes like 1 over CS squared, this is exactly the condition that you expect from sort of your intuition from the previous slide. It's also been derived in sort of a much more roundabout but interesting way in the sort of effective field theory of inflation paper here, where they have the same result. And let me just remind you that in the case of a slow wall, you had this. So there's a very interesting difference that P zeta here can be greater than 1, and perturbative is that if you like zeta, you can have fluctuations greater than 1 here, you can't and be perturbative. So that's just something about eternal inflation.
The perturbation theory, field theory breaks down. Right?
Yeah, so.
But does not mean the zero mode field theory breaks down. Right? Two different statements.
Yeah,
but CS is really coming from a zero mode.
That's right. So that's interesting, right? That's what exactly why you can use your. In fact, you thought you set the background CS evolution by some other physics and check if that's reasonable.
But if the fluctuations start to grow large, then it wouldn't be a perturbation away from homogeneous background.
But these are two different statements. It's possible maybe you have some other kind of perturbation pop up, but zero mode is still there. Because zero mode is determined, for example, by the background.
It depends on which one you're talking about.
But what I'm trying to say is, if just from this argument, you cannot say CS cannot be smaller than that value.
No, in fact, that's not what I'm saying, right? All I'm saying is if you're using that to calculate your non-Gaussianity, you need to do something different. You need to do something different, right?
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay, great.
So the difference between, I think, non-perturbative field theory and non-perturbative gravity. So this is non-perturbative field theory, but gravity is also
perturbative by something. Yeah, gravity can be by something else.
Okay, so so if I go back to this point, you can see that if I put in a numerical value here,
this is much less constraining than the observed value. So why is this interesting? Well, it's exactly interesting because you can have a system that evolves, and you need to make sure that that system is sensible for enough e-folds that we see. And you might want to check predictions at scales other than the CMB, basically. So what I can do is just plug in the scale dependence that we've parametrized in terms of kappa and the spectral index here for both of these quantities. So here's my spectral index scaling. Here's the kappa scaling. You can rearrange in various ways. And since your log k over k naught for roughly constant h is just proportional to number of e-folds, you can correct this slightly, you know, to include the running of h, of course. But you can get an expression for essentially the number of e-folds you can get before you need to change your story. So before either you need to have this kappa not constant doing something else, or before you need to somehow figure out how to deal with the fact that you need to reorganize your information to calculate perturbatively. So here's any max. I can just draw a picture of that, and in terms of background information, so not super useful for observationalists yet, can organize that in terms of the log of the sound speed at the scale you want, say CMB scale, compared to the running that you want. And this is a contour plot just showing essentially the number of e-folds you get from that previous formula before you're out of the perturbative regime. So you can see, of course, that both if the sound speed is very small or if the running is very large, you can't get much inflation before you need something else to happen. But of course, when you go back to the slow roll regime, and you turn off the running, then you can be fine. OK, so as we already discussed a little bit, really this was just one condition. And there's a whole family of conditions here. Yeah.
Like the tensor argument, where you say, when I'm running at -0.3.
Yeah. So I think basically you need to have a change, right, which does happen in realistic geometry. So that's part of the story that I'll get to. OK, so really, this is a family of conditions. I'm only showing you one, because that's the one that's easy to get from perturbation theory. But essentially, you need all of this to be true.
And in sound speed models, you are reduced from some of your work simply because if the sound speed is small, then the dominant terms in this expansion are the ones coming from the sound speed. So I think Gary mentioned various people have papers discussing this. But these terms are pretty easy to calculate. And you can see the interesting fact that just like in slow roll, of course, if you have interactions in the potential, you pick up more of these sort of Hubble slow roll hierarchy parameters. Here, when you have more complicated dependence on the kinetic term, you just pick up a family of parameters that's telling you about those higher derivatives. But the interesting thing is, there's this family of terms here. There's always a term that looks like this for the dominant piece. And there's always a piece that has a scaling like this with q zeta and cs squared. And you can do the same thing at L4. It's a long expression, but the basic point is the first piece, again, has L2, and it has the same factor to a higher power. So that's nice. That looks sort of like an expansion type parameter. And you can again say, OK, what happens if you have scale dependence here? Well, the funny thing is, right, all these terms, because of their structure, have a coefficient in front that's getting smaller, of course, at each order. But they also have a scale dependence here with this kappa and ns minus 1. And I can just rearrange that into something with less variables. So I've just condensed all of the numbers here, the scale dependence here, and simplified the coefficient or the exponent. For q greater than 0, basically, you know, kappa greater than ns minus 1 over 4, it looks a little bit like a problem, because essentially your higher order terms have a scaling such that you want to make sure that when you do this calculation, you can truncate the action at, say, the point we did, S3. and you don't have some contribution from, you know, your 14th order correlation function somehow popping in and kicking you, you know, that doesn't make sense, right? We wouldn't trust our truncation then. So what you do, I don't know, but here's just graphically what that looks like, and probably people with more experience in some sort of field theories might know what to do, but you can again just see that basically if I want to trust my theory out to a scale k, I need to make sure that this is happening in the sense that I can stop, say, at L5, and nothing is large here. And this is not happening, so that if I stop my theory at a scale here, higher order correlation functions fall on this side of the line. And I haven't done that calculation, so I'm in trouble.
For what?
For a small k.
Well, are you? Because if you think about, you know, L650, if you have a situation like this, these things are scaling up and up and up. So unless you know that you can stop, you have some reason that you don't have those terms there. You know, I don't know. So.
Are you saying that at some small enough k you will always have?
Yeah, because I mean that there was a scaling with k.
Like even the bad case. Yeah. So there's a very part of the left here.
Is that true? If you're above that line, then you're not fine. Is that?
You're not fine because this was the scaling that I, you know, sort of like my S3 over S2 less than one condition, right?
Oh, okay.
So you're not fine if you're above that line. And if you try to calculate here only 5 terms, and you've got 6 more terms that are above that line, it doesn't make sense, right? So basically what you can do is just rearrange those terms and get a condition on the coefficient. So basically, if you have small enough stuff in front of those terms, you don't have to worry. So you can see what that condition is, and it gives you a condition on the coefficient of the nth term compared to the nth minus one term. Okay. Probably this is not exactly the right answer, because I've just done something very simple by looking at terms in the Lagrangian, right? So probably this is a conservative answer, and you can violate this and still be fine. But to understand that, you need to look at, you know, maybe loop corrections, or you need to look at how all the terms that I've dropped come up together and add together. So there are some issues here. But I would say if you want to do any work, or minimum amount of work, and you want to write down a phenomenological theory and trust that it makes sense, you could try imposing a condition like this.
Plot, it was scale dependent.
That's
so
right.
Only thing that this would impose is just a cutoff, change in the cutoff in your k.
Well, given the number of terms that you have, so say you keep 3 terms, if the coefficients don't look like this, right, if you don't want to keep all of those terms, I agree you can make a choice of, let's pretend I only have x terms, and let's pretend that I know by which scale that last term is valid. What I'm saying is you're not guaranteed that you don't really generate the higher order term, right, and that its scaling doesn't do this. So you do have some choices, but if you want to write down, for example, something that's, you know, a coefficient for some power, you know, you write some expansion where you generate that coefficient term by term, I'm just saying that's probably a good idea.
But the coefficient is k to some positive power, or?
Well, it depends, right? For the cases that are phenomenologically interesting, like for getting large tensors, or for using small CS to help you get a lot of equals, that kappa is negative, and since n is minus 1 is so small, it can't be solved down there.
So that's negative. No, that's just the positive
power. Yeah, if kappa is negative, so then the kappa is negative. Okay, so what happens if I take these ideas and apply them to DBI and to the result you saw yesterday about large-scale structure? Basically, given a particular model, you can just convert those sort of parameter, you know, phenomenological parameter expressions into an expression for what we actually observe, FNL, and if you want to parameterize by some index here, how FNL runs on scale, you can make a plot that you can just check your observations against. And here's, just like the CS plot versus kappa, here's an FNL versus this essentially kappa again, but just relabeled for you. With the appropriate coefficient for DBI, which just gives you some number here to translate between FNL and CS squared. So just apply it. And let me just point out that the interesting thing is that also, if you know the background theory, gives you some constraint on what happens there.
And a really interesting thing happens in these brain inflation models, because we know that this geometry doesn't actually go to some singular point at the bottom, but it has to smoothly cut off in some reasonable way. And what that means is a schematic, but what that means essentially is that this warp vector, instead of running at very small r, so as you go farther and farther down, instead of running to 0, actually goes to some constant. It goes smoothly to a constant. So that means that kappa goes to 0. So you can easily imagine that it's completely legitimate to have something that runs for a while, goes to a constant, and is perfectly fine. But that's an example of what you might want to check, or when pose happens. Okay. What about the large-scale structure measurements? You can see that if I write schematically So these are the cumulants now. Sorry, I should have relabeled this. These are schematics of the cumulants that appeared in our expansion, say the Edgeworth expansion. And I've just given them the same scaling as they get from the terms in the action. There's really some integral over you know, slightly k-dependent integral over triangles there. But let's just pretend it looks roughly like this with some coefficient that I'm going to add by hand to get that value of that integral. And you can see that an interesting thing happens. This is a reasonable, oh, you don't see the labels. I'm sorry. Basically, this is S3, the skewness, the kurtosis, and S5 here. So you can see that there's some region of the expansion where you can trust because the skewness is large, but the kurtosis is small. Higher order cumulants now are small. But there's some region where, in principle, you might run into trouble and not be able to do a calculation using something like Edgeworth. So basically, this is tying the fact that perturbation theory during inflation is in some sense related to perturbation theory afterwards, right? We want to calculate structure stuff using perturbation theory. So if I just let kappa go to zero in some smooth way, like a tangent, all of these things fall off nicely, and you can see that you don't have to worry too much beyond some scale. So again, if you want to say, you know, in order to get all these reasonable values, I have to cut off the sound speed at some value, you don't expect to see significant non-Gauss Kennedy past that scale. And that's correlated with the fact that you can't, or else your perturbation theory wouldn't make sense. So, of course, you might imagine doing something different where you understand how to change variables, get that non-Gauss Kennedy back, et cetera, but that's a little more work. What does that do for the results that, for example, Marilena showed? Nothing, actually, it's fine. Basically, just because if you plug in the relevant numbers here, you see that we haven't run very far in scale, and because kappa is small, we haven't actually run very far up. So we've run up to FNL of like 1,000. The limit is something like this. So you would expect that on scales a little bit smaller than this, something else has to happen. And then the question is, can you actually observe that? I don't know, with a lot of work, right? And let me just point out that the scale-dependent argument you can see in 2 seconds was a little bit naive, because I can check for DBI, where I know the exact action, what the exact coefficients are at any order. And I can check, and I can see it looks good, doesn't look so good. So DBI, which is a theory which I would think somehow has a built-in sensibleness to it in terms of those coefficients, doesn't actually satisfy this bound. So probably this bound is a little bit too tight, but it'd be interesting, very interesting, to try and figure out how to relax it. So future directions, one thing that I would like to understand better, and again, maybe, you know, people with experience in physical systems know, a better understanding of how to deal with this scale dependence. Because it's an interesting thing to look for, but if it's there, we have to understand how to make it consistent in the model. Of course, this whole general picture is to continue to relate these sort of phenomenological bounds. So I showed you CS breaks, you know, CS too small, this breaks down. What does that mean back in my background picture? So for example, in brain inflation, you know DBI action has a limited regime of validity. You know that you're running to lower energy scales. You have back reaction on the background geometry. So you can probably just check in some interesting way that these are consistent or what they mean in the background. Or if, in fact, you can run past this, but you just have to, you know, make a slight modification. It gets back to this. What happens either both if you're looking for stochastic eternal inflation or if you're looking at the low scales in inflation, what happens outside of that regime? What does it mean? And what other things that we haven't thought of can we possibly write down? So in summary, I think the sound speed model and this whole exercise of thinking about large non-Gauss Kennedy is fantastic because it forces us to think a little bit harder about consistency constraints. And one that we pick up seems to be a minimum sound speed or a maximum non-Gauss Kennedy as long as we're doing one perturbative calculation. That's becoming more relevant for reconstruction programs, not so much in the past, probably because these constraints weren't particularly strong. And it's great to try and sharpen these, understand, again, what they mean, what non-perturbative cases mean. And in short, this is great because non-Gauss Kennedy, real signal or not, is a really fun game for theorists. So, thanks.
Where did that 6800, oh, sorry, got it.
I just wanted to ask Niaj's question again. If you go to k equals 0, that should be the homogeneous limit again. So you have to have a limit by definition required in the first term dominating.
I guess I think in any reasonable sense that extension has to make sense, right? So any reasonable model to give you something that does go to zero.
But I guess not even unreasonable. I just mean like by that. If k goes to zero, that means that you're taking the limit where you're looking at.
I guess that if you have something that's too large and k goes to zero limit, I think that has to correspond to your fluctuation having larger energy than your background solution.
So I think probably the two bounds that are separated them should come outside, something like that.
Isn't it not a frustration anymore? I
mean, yeah, exactly. So if you find it's too large, it needs to be part of your background vector, I think.
So I'm just wondering where that 6,800 came from.
Oh, it's just plugging in the number and converting, right? We know the co-normalization.
Some Kappa was playing.
And we know, exactly.
But I imagine there are better constraints on it for now, on small scales.
Better constraints than?
Than 6,800.
I guess from, they're probably around 2,000. They probably are better at this point, but, I guess the reason that I originally asked this question is thinking about primordial black holes, because that's the only constraint that I can think of that's a very, very small scale. We can ask QEC if there are too many primordial black holes computed here, because you run so strong.
Is that the constraint problem?
No. That I think cannot happen if you have a sensible theory, but you have to know how to take that whole panel distribution. So maybe there's some other problem in that region that I think. Is there anything between clusters and primordial black holes?
Bunch of stuff from, I don't know, reionization, dark matter.
Stars.
Yeah, so how much work do you have to do to put the patches
in there? Yeah. But I mean, all the arguments about early reionization would come up.
So
a of, 100 or something.
Oh, great. Okay, so that would be great.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm not clear. Are these just supposed to run with no change?
Well, that's the question. I mean, that's the simplest way you can sort of parameterize that scale dependence, and it's semi-sensible.
Right. Because I presume you can rule out, k of 10 to the 5 on scales of 100, because it would start doing very weird things.
That would be great.
Like all your matter would be locked up in very dense lumps, or something.
Yeah, I mean, the scale, we are finding like a, 30% change in number of clusters, so I don't know if you scale that result out.
Sorry, on which?
Yeah. So the cluster result that Maureen presented, basically this type of thing makes some sort of like 30% change in mass number of clusters. So if you scale that in there, orders of magnitude.
I was just thinking more if you, my impression was that now it's like 10 to the 4 plus.
Yeah.
Seem very.
Yeah, I was just trying to quantify. It's the same kind of thing, I guess. You run into trouble with the further out you go, you're going further out of scale. But probably you need some way to basically.
Theoretical trouble or
physical trouble? Expansion trouble. Yeah. You need some way to quantify not just the smoothness, but how non gas needed in terms of all those moments.
Okay.
Still the same question. So that means if you go beyond this bound, static field is breaking down. Does that mean, physically, if you find some, for example, how to describe the theory beyond that static field, string theory, you might have FNL bigger than that, right?
The problem you get into for perturbation theory, you run into an analogous problem with perturbation theory in terms of gravitational perturbation theory, right? You cannot have fluctuations so large that your gravitational perturbation theory doesn't make sense. So usually we say if those fluctuations occur in equation, you get like some separate universe, black hole or something. So there's still a hard limit, I would imagine. I mean, I agree, this is not that limit.
I'm not saying it must beyond that.
Sure.
It will be. I just say, before I know what's the underlying theory behind that, I don't know whether FNL can be bigger than that or smaller than that. Beyond the validity region, right?
Yeah. Sure. But the only other point I would make is that you do have a perturbation theory on the other side, and there's probably some hard limit from the fact that perturbation theory is made. Gravitational perturbation theory.
Yeah, so for example, you have whole power of string. Could you put a non-perturbative? I don't know.
I'm talking about
the perturbative structure is even different.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.